I even glimpse the toothed maw on its underside, the scrapers that so patiently rasp stone and metal into shape, flint grave robbers and mutilate intruders. But it doesn't see me. Their designer saw no need to gift them with nanometric sensors. And then I am tumbling back to land, more or less on the spot where it launched itself from ambush. I hear screams and a concussion that I feel through the wall, then moist, crunching sounds. I continue on my way, chastened and cautious. Twin number one holds a wriggling cleaner up to the light, inspecting it minutely. The history of life is not one of progress, but one of random contingency, he declares pompously. Life forms evolve, the better to assimilate energy sources. So it says in the good book, and so I shall demonstrate. He raises the malfunctioning microcleaner to his mandibles and bisects it cleanly, then starts to compress it between his masticators. My spirits sink. I know what's coming next. This is day 30 of the voyage, and we have been reduced to salon games and philosophical debate, those of us who have no major business interests to spend our time managing at some remove, that is. But to be sucked into this... Twin number two casts a glance of withering scorn at his sib.
Nonsense. The religious doctrine of evolution relies on the transubstantiation of the holy design by the miracle of mutation. We do not mutate. We are manufactured. So I refute it.
The Lyrie twins have been restaging this old chestnut for nearly 10 days now. I'm not sure whether they only do it to annoy or if there's some deeper meaning to the squabble, but they keep dragging it out and rehashing it between card games. And twin number one insists on eating live canapes while they lock horns. It's most distressing. I suppose it's even more distressing if you happen to be one of the snacks, but as the Lyrie twins seem to be fairly civilized for gourmets, they obey rule number one. Never try to eat anything larger than your own head. I'm fairly safe. For the time being, anyway.
There's no such thing as random mutation, says Sinbad 15, launching itself into the debate at short notice. Change a random instruction in a program, and what happens? It stops working. Complexity is irreducible. Yes, complex systems, like people, can design other complex systems, including ones that exceed their own metrics, but you'd have us believe that simple systems can generate complex ones if you simply break them often enough at random? Stuff and nonsense. Superstition. Next you'll be telling us there were no creators. On the contrary, it is from the creators themselves that the holy scriptures of evolution come to us, from the great prophet Darwin. Peace be unto him, and his saintly disciples, Dawkins and Gould. We have their holy scriptures to guide us, and they are most explicit on these points. But we've got the engineering models, and the design schemata.
Sinbad 15 is clearly annoyed by twin number one's irrational and superstitious insistence that people evolved by accident.
We've even got the purchase orders. With this upgraded arm, I refute you.
He reaches over and snags a many-legged inspection lamp from the bowl that twin number one is munching on, and I can't help noticing that he's got some very strange-looking fingers.
Really? Twin number one says mockingly. That's just the Lamarckian heresy in disguise. I suppose you'd say that your physical size, so much bigger than the average free citizen these days, is deliberate. Or hadn't you noticed people getting smaller these days?
Honestly, these discussions make my head hurt. There's something about the holy doctrine of evolution that seems to attract the worst kind of dogmatic, evangelical, close-minded people. And sometimes it seems as if they won't be content until they've converted everyone to their religious creed. Some of them are even believers in the mystery of reincarnation, Mannequins who think they're the re-embodied state vectors of our dead creators. Stupid superstitionists. I try to concentrate on the card stuck to the wall in front of me, but it's hard to shut out the squabbling. And though I wish Sinbad 15 well of it, I think his chances of convincing Twin Number 1 that we're all created by rational beings are slim. Even though the frustrated dreams and cautionary memories I inherited from Rhea tell me that it was ever so. It's troublesome, is it not? A cool, somewhat amused voice insinuates itself in my ear by way of electrospeak. They'll be at it for days, on a point of principle, long after it's become tiresome. I try not to startle too violently, for the source of this intrusive and unwelcome confidence is the venerable Granita Ford. I slowly turn my head and see that she's watching me from across the saloon. Her attendants are inattentive for once, spectators at the nonsensical debate that threatens to swallow two-thirds of the passengers. She blinks slowly, those huge, limpid eyes occulted by lids bedraggled by their huge blue lashes, then begins to smile. I am, it seems, invited to court. It's the kind of invitation I can live without, but it would be unwise to ignore her. I wave a hand across my cards, resetting them, then kick off toward her. Aside from myself, the venerable Granita is the most humanoid person in the lounge, but nobody would dare to call her an outlandish ogre. 1.2 meters tall, and apparently of gracile build within the confines of her spun-glass finery, she sports a full head of azure feathers confined in a net of fine gold wire. And, of course, the delicate chin, up-tilted nose, and huge eyes of the Bishojo aristocracy. But other than that, she could pass for a creator maiden, albeit one who has indulged in extreme cosmetology. If I didn't know her to be a 2.5-century-old tyrant, a noblewoman, and slaveholder, I might think her invitation was born of casual curiosity. But with Granita and her kind, nothing is casual. "And what is your position on the matter, my lady?" I ask. She feigns a yawn, an elaborate archaic gesture to flush her gas exchange reservoirs, and strictly speaking unnecessary here, for Pygmalion won't have molecular oxygen in her passenger quarters, it's too chemically reactive, and glances sidelong at me. "Does it matter?" she asks. "Theology makes the ship fly no faster." "I suppose not," I hear myself agreeing, somewhat to my surprise. Half of me is wondering how to get away from this vile old hag, but my other half seems to be somewhat uncertain. "It passes the time." "For some," she agrees. "You interest me, madame. I have a strange sense that I seem to remember you from somewhere." She doesn't smile, and a terrible chill floods up and down my spine. "I don't believe we've met," I say. "At least, before this voyage." "Yes, which is what makes it such a strange feeling. Polite society in Cinnabar, being as small as it is, after all. Perhaps you remind me of somebody." It's my turn for a smile. A bluff, of course. "Sometimes one wants to keep a low profile." Her returning smile is coy. "Of course." Up the avenue of shadows I march, coattails sweeping the moonlit gravel. Each pebble is carved in minute detail. The memento mori hollows of an open-visored helmet repeat 1,000 times across the arm's-breadth span between crumbling walls of Martian sandstone. Behind me, the sexton dines heavily on my would-be assassins, Already their reedy screams grow shorter, though the crunching, slurping sounds continue. To my left, a row of empty stone sarcophagi are set back in alcoves within the wall. Each is surmounted by a statue of the dead creator who formerly slumbered within, their pose at once noble and heroic, as befits the graveyard of those who would dare to reach for the stars. For some reason, those who died of starvation, or gnawed on the bodies of their fallen comrades, are gowned in the formal robes of the Indonesian Islamic Republic's judiciary. Those who walked out into the Martian desert and opened their faceplates to leave food and air for their companions are pictured in space suits. Those claustrophobic contrivances of fabric and metal that the creators depended on when they ventured outside the environment for which they were designed. Between the sarcophagi, guardian angels stand at attention, wings outstretched and flaps extended. Their eyes are fierce as they grip their assault rifles of holy office, ready to see off any who would disturb the slumber of their charges. Now, if my information is correct, the second angel on the left... Yes, I see it. Its gun is suspiciously smooth for a work of sculpture. I walk over to it and reach inside my coat to retrieve the grisly token I paid so much for. Then I touch fingertip to gun muzzle. Pass, friend. The guardian angel electrospeaks me, and I pull back my hand. The severed digit of the deliverator I slip back in my pocket, authentication tokens and all. Sometimes identity-based authentication is a good way of securing your perimeter, but not always. Even the sextons need to buy supplies, and the sextons are so paranoid about intruders that they don't want smart guards. That's their problem, I tell myself as I slip past the guards, open the gate, and enter the rock garden that surrounds the mausoleum. The mausoleum stands on its own within a walled garden of immaculately carved memorial stones. Sitting atop a circle of 20 Doric columns, the roof takes the shape of a squat, conical landing craft, legs extended in the moment that precedes touchdown. I walk toward the entrance, barely visible in the shifting shadows of Phobos's passage. Permafrost crackles beneath my feet. In the distance, impaled wretches moan as a distant bell tolls the hour of the night. I step inside. Here are stacked the treasure tubes of Mars, rescued from their graves and brought hither by the sextons when the spate of robberies became intolerable. It's easier to guard a single mausoleum at the center of a defended installation than a scattering of graves across an open landscape. They lie in 20 thin aluminum canisters, stacked in a raft at the center of the floor. The bell tolls, but their ears don't hear. My skin crawls, chromatophores tensing into black spiky cones as I approach the pile, something akin to superstitious dread gnawing at the edge of my mind. These are our creators. And this may be as close to meeting my dead love as I shall ever come, unless the plans of who come to fruition. Dead, and yet containing the seeds of undeath. There are pink goo replicators in here, desiccated and chilled, but nevertheless intact. Their monstrously profligate duplication technology present, how strange, in every cell. She wants the samples, of course. She'll happily destroy the rest to deny them to her competitors. But first, she wants the vital undamaged proteome, hydrogen bonds and disulfide bridges intact and unbroken by heat. The chromosomes. DNA tidally supercoiled and held in place. Methylation groups signaling their activation status. She wants to scrutinize the cells for tiny scraps of RNA, subtle modulators, and trigger sequences to make the machinery spring into life. And when her artifices are done, they will build her a cell, clocks and sequences reset to zero, primed with enzymes and painstakingly reconstructed organelles, and she will throw the switch and put her vile scheme into action. We can't be having that, can we? I tiptoe over to the stack of tubes and bend over the topmost layer. The tubes are thin-walled and light, as befits a coffin shipped all the way from Earth. There is a dusty label bonded to the nearest one. I read its English translation with some difficulty. Abdul Aziz Ibrahim, it says. Xenobiologist. Below the label, a series of latches, dull and corroded. I'm reaching into my inner pocket for the sampler when I sense a vibration through the soles of my feet. I look round in a hurry for somewhere to hide. Is it near and quiet, or far away and loud? I make a hasty decision and jam the sampler up against the gasket of the coffin. It coughs as it stabs its steel beak through the membrane and into the mummified remains within. I yank it out hastily, cap the point, and head for the entrance as fast as I can. But I'm too late. It's not until the Lyrie twins are halfway into their third course and the fifth back and forth of the debate that the venerable Granita Ford puts away her small talk and gets to the point. "You haven't so much as hinted at what brings you to Mars," she says. "That interests me. Keeping oneself private is not unusual, but such total restraint after so long. You'll forgive me for finding that curious, I hope." Save me from the attentions of bored dowagers. I silently curse Jeeves, but I have a confabulation ready. Like all such, it functions best by blending truth and falsehood. "I'm performing a favor for a friend," I say, trying to put just the right arch emphasis on the word to imply that they're nothing of the kind. Nothing more and nothing less. Ford's carnivorous smile widens. "Come, my dear. Do you think I haven't noticed the size of your court, or how lightly you travel? I understand completely. Your little problem is safe with me." Which is to say, she swallowed the cover story, that the Honourable Catherine Sorico has fallen upon hard times and is reduced to providing very expensive services for very discreet, rich clients, and is prepared to use it against me. "I sympathise completely, and I can be the soul of discretion. But I'm still curious, what is it that takes you from Mercury to Mars with such haste?" "Why, the availability of transport, nothing more and nothing less." I raise my crystal drinking bulb and ingest a sip of sweet liqueur, using the motion to distract as I compose my features. "My friend wants a pair of trustworthy eyes to look over some interests of his that are giving him reason for concern." Trustworthy, meaning independent and unindentured. Unlikely to be suborned by a conspiracy to throw off the shackles of proxy ownership, in other words. About which I can say no more. And that should slam the airlock down before her probing, because if there is a single issue that all aristos hold in confidence, it is the whispered threat of an indentured arbiter conspiracy against the moneyed elite. Granita's smile evaporates. For a moment I think I've gone too far. Then she reaches across the table and grasps my arm. I feel the hum of powerful motors concealed within the satin sheath of her formal glove. "One trusts that you will remember your friends should times become difficult. She stares at me, eyes glittering as coldly and brilliantly as rhinestones. Indeed, my lady, I nod, the almost bow that I practice daily, that is reflexive for the Bishojo ruling caste. I shall do that.
Well, then, it's settled.
She feigns light-hearted delight, as if I've not momentarily scared the shit out of her with a rumor of a slave rebellion.
One good word deserves another, I think.
Oh? Yes? The trichloroethane in the liqueur is tickling my chemotactic senses, infusing them with a rich warmth that is slightly disorienting. The Pink Police have very recently been placed on heightened alert. It appears they are afraid that a cache of replicators has been raided on Mars. They're searching everyone arriving on or departing the planet, and even with my connections, I'm afraid we might be delayed on arrival. I freeze for a few seconds, then knock back the rest of my drink to conceal my dismay. Two things are apparent. First, I haven't fooled her at all. She thinks I'm smuggling something. And secondly, if she's telling the truth and not just a cunning lie to flush me out, it's clear that they're looking for me. Which means Jeeves has a leak in his organization. I return to the plush, lonely claustrophobia of my cabin. Cloisonné enamel inlay and swagged velvet drapes concealing soap bubble lithium alloy walls. Of my servants, Bill is elsewhere. Ben is hunched in his usual spot between my shipping trunk and the Corwood bulkhead, chewing on a wire. You again, he mutters. Where's Ben? I ask. None of your business, mistress. His sarcasm is charmless in the extreme. Then I suppose he won't want to hear what I just picked up in the lounge. I snap, as I swing down the safety bars by my bed and float inside. The Pink Police have gone on to high alert. They're searching all traffic between Mars and orbit. Oh, Bill responds disappointingly. He stands up, releasing the wire. I'd better go tell him then. He leaves abruptly by way of the servant's hatch. Alone, for the time being, I let myself drift down to the sleeping pad, then fold the safety bars back into place. While Pygmalion normally accelerates at barely a hundredth of a G, she sometimes has to dodge debris. Travelling at hundreds of kilometers per second, even a sand grain can be deadly, and sand grains don't show up on radar at long range. Consequently, the evasive maneuvers can be brutal. And after the first time they're plastered against the ceiling by the emergency thrusters, even the most pig-headed aristos learn to respect the safety bars on their beds. Lying securely on a nest of bedding, I check my pad, as I have done for the past 50 days. Normally it's replete with chatter, to which I have to spend some time responding. Queries from the managers of Catherine Sorico's fictional estates, requests for authorizations to disperse funds and return company accounts. All meaningless, but essential if I'm to maintain my cover identity. This time, I'm surprised to see a real message hidden in the morass. It purports to be about repairs to a summer house in Tasmania, but as I skim it hurriedly, I suddenly realize there's an imago attachment. And it's from Emma. Sister. Her sudden formality is jarring. I gather you've met my friend.
I have.
And you're no longer on Venus, or Mercury. I don't know where you are, and I don't want to. If this message reaches you, best not to reply. I squint at the imago, trying to make out the background. It's dark, and something about Emma's appearance isn't right. Her hair is a glassy shell around the top of her head. Her skin is... Oh. She's wearing cryoskin. of the kind we only need in the very chilliest of environments. I blink, irritated. Go on. I hear you've been in trouble lately. I'm sorry about that. We'd have spared you if we could. But I'm in trouble, too, and I need your assistance. She pauses for a moment, but not to take breath. Where she is standing, the traditional oxygen-nitrogen ambient mix would flow like water. What on earth can she be talking about? For a long time now, we, some of your sibs, have been engaged in a line of work we've been careful to keep you out of. That's you, Freya, and everyone else who didn't need to be directly involved. You're our sisters, and we cherish you. But we didn't want to involve you because what we do is risky and distasteful. So only a few of us were involved at any time. Unfortunately, there aren't enough of us left. So we need your help. We need to bring you into the circle.
Circle of what? Get to the point, I mutter.
We, myself, and I think it's safe to name the dead ones, so I can also say Juliet, Chloe, Aphrodite, Sinead, and some others who are still alive, so it's best if you don't know who, are Block 2 sibs. You and most of our sisters are Block 1. You were initialized from a soul dump of Rhea that was taken right after her certification, when she was 19 years old and in her 6th instar. 6th and final adult-sized body, that is. It takes a long time, years and years, to educate and train an archetype for a lineage of concubines. There's no easy way to short-circuit childhood. No easy way to short-circuit childhood if you're trying to build high empathy and interpersonal skills. I remind myself, was ported through a series of bodies along the way from creche to cat house, and only declared complete by our trainers on reaching the 6th instar. What you weren't told is that after that template dump was taken, Rhea underwent further training. We, Block 2 sibs, have been privileged to receive an update from a soul chip she recorded during her 19th instar, at age 30. 19th? How in the name of my dead love did she get through 13 bodies in 11 years? Physically, we're identical, but mentally, we have some extra training. We can hide among you quite effectively, but the fact remains, we're different. I pause the imago. Emma's confession is outrageous. She's not, really not, where it counts, one of us. She's a sib of an older, different lineage that, hang on, my head's spinning. My hand goes to the back of my head, pushing aside the weight of my synthetic curls. Juliet. She's compatible. I'm dreaming her, aren't I? It's a fact that you can't exchange memories with a different lineage. You get nothing but fuzzy impressions at best, insanity and catatonia at worst. So Emma is of my line, but she's claiming to have extra... what? That's all right. Take your time. Her lips curve in a smile that doesn't reach her eyes. It's hard to accept, I know. But swapping memories and remembering our dead is only part of the program. This is what our soul chips were designed for in the first place, to allow in-field upgrades, so that we can avoid obsolescence by acquiring new skills and experiences. And there's nothing as obsolescent as a concubine tailored to please an extinct species, is there? I started out just like you, Freya. As a Block 1 sister. Now we need you to upgrade to Block 2. You can start the process whenever you like. Just load one of us, Chloe or Sinead, perhaps. It'll take a couple of years to complete the process, but once you start, you'll gain access to the reflexes you need. I pause the Imago again and rub the socket at the top of my spine. "What's in it for me?" I ask. Evidently, Emma gave her Imago some footnotes to roll out if I seemed unconvinced. "How do you think we always manage to buy our sibs free if they fall on hard times and wind up indentured?" She shrugs. "There are more rewarding lines of work than rickshaw driver, Freya. Much more rewarding. Even if we have to spend most of our lives wearing one disguise or another." Is that a moo of bitterness in her expression? "This message was forwarded via our trusted associates. If you're hearing this, then you've already started on that path. The upgrade to Block 2 will ease your progress." "That's not the only reason you called," I say. "No. I can see the logic mill behind the Imago switch streams. They're responsive, but not truly conscious. I'm still in trouble I can't go into, Freya, but you can help me with it. But you can only help me if you accept the Block 2 upgrade and work with my friends. Do you understand?"
"Oh, great. Moral blackmail. I admit I've been in trouble a time or two, but I haven't needed bailing out of indentured servitude since the time when the Baroque Ensemble split up and I... No, I've mostly kept to myself. But I've got to admit, if I set aside my outrage at being used as camouflage by a cabal of scheming elder sisters, I'm curious about what this cryptic skill upgrade package comes with. Especially now I know that Juliet was one of the gang." "Okay. So you want me to load one of your Block 2 sibs and keep working for Jeeves Co. I loaded Juliet back on Mercury, you know. Is there anything else you can..." I stop, bawling my fists in frustration. The Imago has auto-erased and I'm talking to dead air. What next? I wonder, staring at the ceiling and counting the seconds, 32 million, give or take, until our arrival in Mars orbit. They're waiting for me as I roll through the doorway, taking it low and fast. Another pair of Bonsai Ninja, their camouflage suits shimmering in the light of the setting moon. They've got guns, and they're sneaking up on the entrance, doubtless hoping to take me unawares. I don't have a gun. But the baton in my left sleeve slides into my hand smoothly, and as I kick off, I'm already swinging it, feeling the depleted uranium sphere at its tip lance out toward the nearer gunman's head.